short story,
sat under the Bodhi tree and said, I am not moving until I realise the truth. And then he was able to see absolutely the nature of reality, how everything functioned. He became awake. He understood what was going on. And he found that truth out for himself through deep, deep introspection and meditation. He understood what was going on. And so that was the question when someone met him. Who are you? Are you a god? Are you a human? No, I'm neither of these. I am awake. I have gone from a sentient being, someone that experiences suffering, to someone that is completely awake and understands the whole nature of reality, how everything fits together. And so the Buddha then decided what to teach, because he felt like he should impart it. At first he wasn't going to teach, and it said the gods Indra came to him and said, please, you've got to share this stuff with others, you can't just keep it to yourself. And he went, all right, but what am I going to teach? What am I going to teach with this vast knowledge that I've just received of the phenomena of all phenomena? And when you look at and there's a whole text on what a Buddha knows, and a Buddha's mind, it's just an inkling of it, a Buddha has the past, present and future knowledge of all beings' thoughts in every universe, all at the one moment. The capacity of the mind to be completely omniscient with every particle of matter and every consciousness, all at the one moment. So what do you do when your mind's just gone chomp? What are you going to say to someone whose mind is extremely finite? Who thinks about their next meal? Who thinks about shelter? What are you going to say to them that's going to be relevant? Hey man, this stuff's really big. That doesn't kind of work, does it? So he first taught the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths, he thought, were really evident to people. And the first truth was, there is suffering. There is dissatisfaction. So what does that mean? It means we don't get everything we want and we become disappointed. We receive stuff that we don't want and become disappointed. And there's a hell of a lot of dissatisfaction from day to day. How many people here have had a complete day where everything has been perfect? Your body is completely comfortable. Your mind is completely comfortable. You have no bills to pay. You have exactly the right amount of money. You're not tired. You're not stressed. You're not worried about something. Well, I'm still waiting. Even an itch can irritate us. And it's not so much, when he talked about suffering, it wasn't gross suffering where you've got a stomach pain and you're really, really in agony, but just the constant dissatisfaction of not getting what you want and receiving what you don't want. So this was the first truth, that there is suffering. And everyone went, yep, I've had a bit of suffering. No, I've actually had a lot of suffering. Yep. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Okay. So you can check it through, and you can work out that you do have dissatisfaction. I'm going to take this watch off. Get my gun. And so he said, there is a cause of that. There is a reason for that. Well, that's interesting. Okay. So I'm going through this dissatisfaction. There is a reason for it, and the reason is karma, cause and effect. It is the way that we generate seeds of dissatisfaction that cause us to suffer. So there is a cause to it. Hello. And so that's the second noble truth. There's a cause to it. The suffering, there's a cause to it. Third noble truth is, there is a path out of this suffering. you can actually get out of it, and the fourth noble truth is there's an end to it. So he gave you the bad news, right? Life's crap. And he gave you the good news that you can get, you can dig your way out of it. And that was the whole relevance of the Buddha, because the Buddha said, I did it. I'm not a god. I am a human being that has transcended the suffering state and become awake. And you can do it too. And this is the extraordinary thing that the Buddha was able to convey. There is a path out of suffering. There's a path out of this dissatisfaction. And so that was his first truth, the Four Noble Truths. This was the first teaching. Buddhism then spread over, and this is a bit of historical information, some of you may or may not know, it then started to spread. The Myanmar-Burma tradition says that the Buddha visited Myanmar four times during his lifetime, which is really interesting. There's also the fact that the Buddha went to Sri Lanka. It reached Thailand about 218 years after the Buddha's death. It got to China, and when we say got to China, there'd been inklings of it going to China, but when China adopted it as a state religion was about 70 AD. It then ended up in Korea about 300 AD. So it was India, Sri Lanka, Thailand and Burma. Burma first probably, Sri Lanka. Then ended up in Korea about 300 AD. Ended up in Tibet about 600 AD. And ended up in Japan around 700 AD. So it travelled all over the place, and then it came further to southern Asia, ended up in around Indonesia in about probably the 10th or 11th century. So it started to spread. The spread was interesting. Buddhism had a very interesting way of moving into each country. Instead of going into a country and saying, look, what you're doing is completely wrong, you have to change, the Buddhism that came in with the wisdom of the teachers, they said, well, what works for you in your culture? Let's just assimilate that into the Buddhist understanding. What's good, what's beneficial for everyone here, and what works, why don't we just assimilate that into the practice of Buddhism? And so what you end up is you have Tibetan Buddhism, you have Japanese Buddhism, Korean Buddhism, you have, you know, Thai Buddhism, all different flavours. Same basic principles, but with different flavours, like different sources. And so you get the quality of that culture within the trappings of the country. In the Zen tradition, it's incredibly simple. Very simple. Very simple practice. Meditation, meditating sometimes on a koan to open the mind, but very simple. And often you see even the Zen robes that the monks use are very simple. You look at the Tibetan tradition, there's colour everywhere. You know, it's like this explosion of colour. You see their tankas and there's reds, greens, blues, reds, orange, colours, everything. Huge explosion of colour. Many rituals that happen within cultures are to remove oneself from the ordinary and mundane living, to take oneself into a different space, to inspire oneself to open the mind in different ways. And so if you can think of what Tibet is, it's basically grey rocks, ice, snow, blue skies. So if you go into a Tibetan temple, if everything's grey, blue and white, it's not going to be very inspiring. So what do they have? Explosion of colour within the temple. In the Zen tradition, very simple. And all the different cultures have the different qualities within that to inspire the people to leave behind their mundane thinking when they enter the temple, and to inspire themselves to look for the deeper truths within the removal of that mundane experience. And so that's why ritual is there, to remove us. Some, even in the Tibetan tradition, you have some of the sects have very elaborate rituals and some not so much. again in the Zen tradition too. So these are all different flavours within the Buddhism to inspire the people to look within. In the Tibetan tradition, they don't actually call them Buddhists, they call them Nagpa. Nagpa is a Tibetan word which means one who looks within. Because what most people do, what most of us do, what most of all humanity, but even the animal kingdom, looks for happiness externally. If only, then I'll be happy. If only I could get $1 million, then I'll be happy. Which means everyone that gets $1 million is happy. Not quite. In fact, they've actually done a bell curve of happiness with the amount of money that one has. And they found that people who are absolutely on the poverty line, they become ecstatically happy when they have shelter, food and clean water. There is a huge step in happiness when you don't have food, clean water and shelter. When you get that, it goes from there to there. Huge jump in happiness. It then climbs slowly, interestingly enough, to $150,000. It then only climbs very gradually up to about $1 million, and a little bit further up, and around the 10 million mark, it starts to plummet. And by about the billionaire level, you're back to down to poverty existence. And they reckon this happens, and I kind of thought that was interesting. And then a few years ago there was an interview with a guy who committed suicide, a guy called Rene Rivkin, who you may not have heard of. He was an investor, and he said, and he was worth millions and millions of dollars, and he said the two most miserable people in Sydney are myself and Kerry Packer. He said, we often sit in the Cosmopolitan and talk about how miserable we are. Kerry Packer was worth about $6 billion at the time. And Rene Rivkin committed suicide. So, extraordinary. So, we look externally for this happiness. Thinking, well, if I just get that, and, you know, you can often think, oh, if I just pass these exams, then I'll be happy. Ah, there's another exam. All right, once I get past that, and we often look at life like that, oh, if I just get over this hurdle, then I'll be happy. The sad news is we're on a circular track. And we just have to keep getting over hurdles, over hurdles, over hurdles. But we keep thinking that if we acquire something externally, then we're going to be happy. Sure. If we're in very difficult circumstances and they pass, yes, then we do develop a degree of happiness. But it's not totally dependent on external circumstances. It's about how we view things. It's about our mind. And that was really the relevance of the Buddha. Not who he was, because he was awake, but what is his relevance to us? And his relevance was that he was teaching us to look within. That it's the practice of the mind, the development of the mind that brings us happiness, not the development of our bank account. So this doesn't mean, okay, we're just going to become poor and happy. That doesn't work either. Not about getting rid of stuff or acquiring stuff. It's about how you view it. In the Buddha's teachings, it says you can be bound by a chain of gold or a chain of straw. If you're bound, you're bound. A number of years ago, one of my friends in Melbourne who lived at the Buddhist monastery of my teacher, who's now 88, went to my teacher Geshe Loden and said to him, I've got enough money to buy a Porsche. Do you think I should buy a Porsche? And Geshe Loden said, ah, fantastic, German engineering. Best car. Really good quality. Fantastic. He said, will you be looking at it every 10 minutes to make sure it's not scratched? Will you go and polish it every 10 minutes to make sure it looks beautiful? Will you worry about it when you're going to sleep at night? He said, then your pleasure becomes your torture. If this doesn't happen, then buy the car. And so it's not about the car. It's about your attitude towards it. I was coming, walking out of a car park a couple of months ago, and I saw these two guys leaping around a brand new Audi Sports. I don't know, how much is an Audi Sports car worth these days? I don't know, 80 grand, 90 grand, 100 grand, more? Come on, give us a price. 250. Now, no wonder this guy was leaping around. He's going, and they're jumping in and out, and they're opening the doors, and I'm watching this stuff going on. I was so excited. Anyway, I got in the lift, and the guy said, "Oh, look, I'm really sorry." He said, "I just got this new car, and it's just so fantastic." And I kind of regret saying it. I said, "Oh, I guess it'll be great until you get the first scratch." And he went, and the look of horror on his face was like, "Oh, I hadn't thought about that." And the other guy said, yeah, it's the first scratch that's really the biggest bummer. Now, you know, if he'd got an old Holden second hand that was scratched, he probably wouldn't care about the first scratch because it already had it. So if we look at that stuff, it's kind of amusing the way our mind plays games with ourselves. Things that we hold precious and things that we don't. Doesn't mean, again, that we become irresponsible to our possessions. Oh, by the way, the guy did buy the Porsche. All right? And he still got it quite a few years later. And I asked him when I saw him last month, I said, "How's the Porsche going?" He said, "It's great. It's good to drive." So I guess he analysed it long enough to realise that it was a piece of machinery that he liked driving and that it was fine, but that it wasn't going to become the most important thing in his life. That holding on to that possession wasn't going to become the most important thing in his life. Because, let's face it, I don't like to tell the Porsche company this, but Porsches also do rust out. You know, eventually they will decay. They're impermanent, unfortunately. So, the Buddha was really about teaching us to look within, to look at the mind, to understand how we tick, and understand how phenomena works. And one of the other parts of it, and this is kind of important, is the whole idea of morality and ethics. And I'm not talking about a rigid set, although there are very clear guidelines within Buddhism. It's about an attitude to life and other beings. True morality is the desire not to harm others, bottom line. And if you want to check out whether your morality is working, check out whether it harms others. And it's a great template. Is this action I'm about to do going to harm someone? Ah, well, it's only a bank. I can take more out of the ATM than is necessary. It won't matter. Happened with a Commonwealth Bank the other day. Some guy pulled out $1,500 and told all his friends to come. Wasn't too smart, considering he'd put his key card in. He was traceable. But that attitude, which is, it's okay if I don't get caught, is still stealing. And from a karmic point of view, it still creates an effect. And later on, you're going to have to pay for it. Make your choice, but you're going to have to pay for it. And that's the truth of karma. And that was one of the truths that the Buddha talked about. There is cause and effect. There's only three possibilities in this universe. Complete randomness, where things just happen out of the blue. Cause and effect, or part cause and effect and part randomness. Only three possibilities. Would there be any others? No karma, a bit of karma, a bit of randomness, or all karma. What do you reckon? Or what, just karma? Yeah, so we've got to vote for just karma. We've got to vote for a bit of karma and a bit of randomness. You got to vote for that one? Okay. That means that when we do something, sometimes the result is assured and sometimes it isn't. So when I stick my key in my car to turn it on, all of a sudden it turns into a pineapple. The point being that if you have some randomness and some cause and effect, it's still randomness. So the way the reason I threw it in is, it's a bit of a trick question actually, sorry to set you up. There's just randomness or cause and effect. And we live our lives on cause and effect. We really do. We have to. We have to have a certain understanding that if this thing's sitting here and I put my cup on it, 99% of the time, if it's not broken, it's going to support the cup. There is a cause and there's an effect. There has been causes and conditions that have made this into a non-self-existent table, a table empty of tableness. We won't go into that tonight. Another time. But I do assume, generally, that this table is going to support the cup. So I base my life on many acceptances that if a person puts four legs, screws them into a frame, that this is something that I can support my cup on. So we do have to, in a sense, rely on these things. Otherwise, we plant an apple seed and something completely different grows up. So we base our lives on cause and effect. The cause and effect that we talk about in our own continuum is much more subtle. And the biggest problem with karma that the Buddha talked about is that there is a gap between the cause and the effect. And quite often we don't necessarily see those two working together. Classic example, and I've given this once before, is a guy robs a bank and he's really happy with the outcome of the money that he's got. So in a sense, you could say that good karma has ripened from a bad cause. And the Buddha said that is not possible to happen. You cannot have a negative cause with a positive result. So, the money that the guy got from the bank was in some time eventually going to come to him anyway. The robbing of the bank created a negative karma that was going to result in loss at a future time. So we have all, and this is the complex thing about karma, we have intersecting of every moment the end of a karma and the beginning of a new one, all at the one moment. And it's most prevalent in the fact if someone comes to me and is really angry at me, it's a result of previous causes and conditions that I've set up. It's not a result of some random situation. And when that person is angry at me, it's a result of previous causes and conditions that I've set up. However, if I want to set up future positive causes and conditions, I don't get angry back. If I want an angry person to go away, I have to be nice to them. Sounds incredible, but that's exactly what happens. And then in the future, that person will turn up as a friend, not as an enemy. And we know that it's relevant to ourselves is because the person next to us may not be getting yelled at. May have not created the karma for that to happen. Many, many years ago, I was in a situation walking up Oxford Street where this guy came out of it. I was with a friend, and this guy came out of the bar, walked straight up to my friend and hit him, and just looked at me and shrugged and walked off. Now, my friend luckily had a very tough jaw, and he had been a boxer in his previous earlier years, and he went, "Whoa, that was a hard hit," and we kept walking. He didn't retaliate, thankfully, but the situation was that I hadn't created the karma for this guy to walk up and hit me. Somewhere along the line, my friend had created it in a previous life, somewhere along the line, had created the karma for that to happen. And he looked at me and was no anger at all. And there was no relevance for this situation to happen. It was just out of the blue. So, karmic occurrences happen because we create them. We can't necessarily have created them all this life, because circumstances come out of the blue, but in a previous time we have created the causes and conditions. And so the Buddha was trying to teach us that through our practice of morality, of not harming other beings, we're creating positive karma. It was not only a protection, it's morality of protection for others, it's actually a protection for ourselves. The more we decide not to harm others in any possible way, the more we are creating positive conditions for our own lives. Really interesting thing in Buddhism. What works for others. Always. If you look at all the teachings, teachings on compassion, love, wisdom, all these things, they always work for us if they work for others, and they always work for others if they work for us. There's no downside. We have to understand that the act of generosity benefits ourselves too. And the more we give, the happier we actually become. And it's a really interesting thing that science now has finally caught up and actually understood this process. There's a very famous guy called Matthew Ricard. He was, and some of you know this story, so excuse me for repeating it, but I think it's worth going over it again. Matthew Ricard was a Louis Pasteur scientist, and 30 years ago he'd been this scientist, and he decided that he was going to leave the Pasteur Institute and become a Buddhist monk. So he went to the Himalayas, he became a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and he practiced meditation for 30 years. Wisconsin University wanted to do some testing on brain patterns. And so they thought, well, why not find a scientist who's done meditation practice? So they called him to Wisconsin University, and they stuck the electrodes on. And they had previously found out that when a person was happy, the left temporal lobe lit up. The lights went on when they had the electrodes on. And when a person was feeling sad and negative, the right temporal lobe lit up. When they stuck the electrodes on Matthew Ricard's skull, without him even meditating, this area was lit up way beyond the normal person. So then they got him to meditate, and they found that this got even brighter. And then the most extraordinary thing is they got him to meditate on compassion, and this went off the scale. So the more he meditated on generosity and compassion for others, the happier he became. So the scientific proof is there is now no downside to generosity. But there's always grey areas, which is kind of, for me, fascinating about Buddhism. What if someone comes up to you, I like posing these questions, comes up to you in the street and they ask you for money, and you have a really strong impression that they're going to use that money in a bad way for themselves. They're either a junkie or they're going to go out and write themselves off. What do you do? Do you give them the money out of compassion because you give money out of compassion? Or do you not give them money? What do you do? Come on, just answer. What do you reckon? You're not going to give? If you're pretty sure they're going to use it in a bad way. Yeah. I reckon that's a reasonable assumption. If you can't tell, well, give them the money. But it's kind of, we have to make wisdom decisions. We have, interestingly enough, in the Buddha, you can't really see it there, but he's sitting on a lotus, which means renunciation, and underneath him, actually, is a moon cushion and a sun cushion, representing compassion and wisdom. Very interestingly, that you have wisdom and compassion in Buddhism going together the whole time. If you have compassion without wisdom, you have idiot compassion. A classic example, as I've said here many times over the many years, is the person that decides to take little old ladies across the road when they're standing at the curb, even if they don't want to go across. So you go, oh no, I take little old ladies across the road. And I was here once, and I don't know who it was, but I said that, and then someone said, yeah, I tried that, and then a little old lady started hitting me with an umbrella saying, stop that, I don't want to go. So that's idiot compassion, you don't check. If you have wisdom without compassion, you just have knowledge, don't you? There's no action. In the Tibetan tradition, Wisdom, you'll love this, girls, wisdom is carried by the female. It's a female quality, is wisdom. And it's depicted by the bell that you'll often see in Tibetan Buddha or Tibetan Buddhist rituals. They have a bell in the left hand. And that bell represents wisdom. It's a female quality. Girls know that anyway, don't you? Yeah. Secret girls information. Compassion is an active quality, and that's the masculine principle represented by the Dorji or the thunderbolt. But you need the two together to function well on this planet anyway, and on every planet in the universe. You need the combination of wisdom and compassion together. If you have them separated, you have only one wing of the bird. And then underneath you have renunciation, which is represented by the lotus. And the renunciation we're not talking about is giving up chocolate. It's not about giving up chocolate, okay? So you can all relax. I thought renunciation was about giving up chocolate. I'm giving up this Buddhism, I like chocolate. No, it's about giving up negative states of mind and the causes of negative states of mind. All negative states of mind cause us and others harm. By giving those up, we are renouncing negative states of existence, and we are, every time we make a positive statement, we are removing ourselves from samsara. Every time we make a positive action, I meant to say, we remove ourselves from samsara. Every time we make a negative action, we bind ourselves tighter to the wheel of rebirth. We tighten ourselves to this cage of dissatisfaction. Every time we make a positive action, we break a few more bars of the cage of constriction that we have. Because we all want to be free. We want to be free of the constraints of suffering, of dissatisfaction. So, in a sense, morality is the beginning of that spiritual practice. The morality of not harming others, of helping others, of actually being compassionate, developing our wisdom to help others, and in a sense really helping ourselves. There's no downside to that. And so the Buddhist practice was about developing these qualities, everything that we can work on. And the thing that I particularly like is practical Buddhism. It's not about completely euphoric states of mind, it's about how we deal, how we interface with our everyday lives. How we work in our everyday lives. And yes, we will make mistakes. It's actually said, I don't know where the teaching was, but I did read it once, if every bodhisattva or Buddha in training gave up because of a mistake, then there would be no Buddhas. So we do make mistakes. If we are in the human condition without enlightenment, or we're not an arhat, then we make mistakes. However, there is no point sitting around feeling guilty about it. What I like, the term that I once heard, was intelligent regret. Recognizing a mistake and not doing it again. Getting really clear about an unskillful thing that you've done through lack of wisdom or inattention and going, not going to do that again. It's funny, last night I spoke to someone, I think in a kind of a joking way, but they were kind of a bit more sensitive than I realised, and they kind of reacted a little bit, not quite offended, and I thought later, that wasn't so skillful at that point. And then I realised that person had been going through a bit of a hard time, and I was kind of joking with them in a kind of a loud manner, and I realised that kind of was a bit sensitive, and I thought, okay, I'm going to have to, and this is the point I'm making, it's not, I feel terrible, I'm just going to have to be a bit more skillful when I'm around that person, because they're having a bit of a hard time in their lives at the moment, and I won't be so kind of jovial because they're a bit sensitive. That's what I'm talking about. Moment by moment, checking out what's going on. It's called mindfulness. It's about being aware. And really, this is also the main practice of Buddhism, being aware. What's going on right now? How am I with this person? When the Jehovah's Witnesses come to your front door, which they do to mine regularly, how do I treat those people? Do I have a mandate because they're coming to my front door to be aggressive and rude? Or, even though I'm not of their religion, do I say, nah, I'm a militant Buddhist, get out? Or do I react kindly to them? My decision is to be kind to them, because they're doing the best they can within their practice. It's not the practice that I do, but they're doing the best they can, and they think that coming to my front door is beneficial for me. And so they talk to me for a little while. I usually say I'm in a bit of a hurry, because I usually am when they come. I don't know how they pick it. I'm either on the phone, or I'm about to walk off out the door, and they knock on the door and say, oh, we've come to talk to you about... I go, okay. And the other week they said, oh, there's a passage in the Bible about love and compassion and how we should treat everyone. And I said, yeah, I totally agree. Should be about love and compassion. And they were really happy that I was agreeing with them. Then they gave me a copy of the Watchtower, and that was fine. But I was genuinely trying to be nice to them, because I thought the number of doors they probably get to the front door where someone slams the door in their face and is really rude to them, and that's really tough. So, you know, at the risk of them coming, which they will do, because I'm nice to them and I'll keep coming back, I consider it that they are human beings doing the best they can with what they've got, and probably practicing their religion really purely, so it's not my place to be unkind to them. And so there's a situation where I can make a choice, I can make a difference. And they've never asked me what religion I am, funnily enough. They've never said, what religion do you follow? They just say, oh, we've got a passage in the Bible here we thought you might like. So it's fine by me. There's a lot of stuff in the Bible that's fantastic. The Tibetan Buddhists look on Jesus as a bodhisattva. Why not? So it's about how we interface with the world moment by moment. Do we take the last piece of cake? Do we keep the 20 cents that's been given to us wrongly from the shopkeeper? Or do we hand it back? It's those things. And those little things are the training of the mind. And interestingly enough, also, when we act within that morality, our minds become peaceful. Our minds settle down. And in the end, it's that contentment that's important to us as in our everyday living. It's this sense of ease, sense of being okay with ourselves. Because the other sense of this agitation, of worry and fear, try someone that's a habitual liar. Can you imagine how many tracks they have to cover? I was once massaging this woman in her house, very wealthy woman in her house, and the phone rang, and she said, quick, tell them I'm not home. She said, answer the phone and tell them I'm not home. And I said, and so I'm the burglar? So what am I doing there? I said, that gets pretty complicated. I said, I can answer the phone and say you're busy, if you don't want them to know you're having a massage, or we can not answer the phone. But I'm not going to answer the phone and say you're not here, because you're right here. And she went, oh, all right, just don't answer the phone. I said, well, there's a solution. But you can see, even with that, if I picked up and went, oh, look, she's not here. Well, I'm a husband, who are you? You know, all of a sudden, you set up these cycles that become more and more ridiculous. Another person rang me up once and said, look, I'm going to tell you something, and if so-and-so says, ask you if you've spoken to me or I've told you, you've got to say you haven't. I said, no, hold on a minute. I said, if they've asked me if I've spoken to you, I'm going to have to say yes, because I have. If they ask me what the content was, I can say I can't tell you, But I said, that's the end of it. And she said, oh, well, I better not tell you then, had I? I said, there's a good choice. The person didn't ring me up and ask me whether I'd spoken to him. But here was someone setting me up in a situation that was going to cause me to create a negativity if this situation arose. So I didn't play the game. She was okay with it. You know, it wasn't a drama. She was okay with it. But in the end, you have to watch those moments as they come up. And the more you practice a calm mind through the practice of meditation, the more you practice that, the more you can see these situations come up. You develop a degree of patience where you don't walk in completely unaware and go, uh-oh, I shouldn't have done all that. You just start to know that there is a way of being. And that was really what Buddhism is about. The practice of meditation gives you the ability to strengthen, calm the mind, and be able to deal with everyday situations. And as the mind becomes calmer, then your practice of meditation becomes deeper. And as you develop the depth of your meditation, the mind becomes more, has more ability to look at the subtle nature of things. How are we going for time? I'll go for time. Any questions so far? Yep.
So let's say you have a friend asking you a couple of questions. Like, let's say the friend was away and then he was supposed to do something for his friend. And he asked me to get a personal check saying that he actually did it. How can I actually do that?
So we've got, let's be really clear. You've got a friend.
Yeah.
They've gone away.
No, the parents have gone away. Like, I was listening.
The parents have gone away, right?
They've gone away. And then he was supposed to practice.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, he fit in, he was doing something else. And then, by the time his parents came back, and yeah, his parents asked him about it, and he told me to back him up, and I actually did. But in that situation, what did I do? Like, if I didn't, like, if I was refusing him,
I think in that situation, you have to be really clear with your friend and say, look, I'm sorry, you have to deal with this. At the risk, if he's a good friend, he'll say, yeah, okay. But say, look, I'm sorry, I'm not going to stand here and lie for you to back you up. There are circumstances within Buddhism where you can lie. Okay? Really interesting. Hunter chasing rabbit. Rabbit goes that way. Hunter says, which way did the rabbit go? You've created negative karma, but you've saved the rabbit's life. No problem. Okay? Yep. Sometimes, some aren't. No, no, no. Some are vegetarian, some aren't. Yeah. Within Buddhism, there is always personal choice. Okay? It's never the information and the doctrine's there, but really in the end, it's an individual practice. So, up to you. There's never it's not like in some religions where you get thrown out in the very strict, some very strict kind of Christian religions where if you don't do this, you're thrown out and ostracized. It's not that. It becomes an absolute. The Buddha basically gave these teachings and said, you make up your, in a sense, you make up your religion out of this. These are the breadth of my teachings. And it said that he gave 84,000 teachings to cover 84,000 delusions. You choose and you make your best decision with that. The Tibetans, some of the Tibetans eat meat, some of them are strict vegetarians. The monasteries in South India, interestingly enough, this is a situation. The Tibetans ate some meat because they couldn't grow vegetables, and they would get, and sometimes some bones and things, and boil them up. So there was that level there. Some of the traders would come past with sides of meat and the Tibetans would buy it because they realised it was sustenance. When the Tibetans got to South India, the monasteries, they were eating some meat, and the Hindus around there got really upset about it. They felt that that wasn't right, that the Tibetans were there and the Hindus were not eating meat, not eating beef, And so the Dalai Lama said, if the Hindus are being upset, then all the monasteries are now vegetarian, completely. Because these people have given us their land out of compassion, because we've been exiled, we must not upset them, so therefore, monasteries, vegetarian. But that doesn't mean that a monk in those monasteries can't go outside sometimes and eat meat if they wanted to. They're not penalised for that. That is their own choice. The Dalai Lama said it's better not to eat meat, but if that's the case, it's not the worst situation that happens. Interestingly enough, and this is where you get this big debate about non-killing and eating meat. For Buddhists, and there's, I guess this gets, if there was no killing in the world, all Buddhists would have to be vegetarian per se. Because there's a piece of meat sitting in a supermarket and they didn't kill it, they go, well, it's sitting there anyway. So it's a very grey debate there, and it's been held, and I've seen it going on for the time I've been a Buddhist, for 30 years. Depends on your own mind, actually. And you have to make that own decision within yourself. That's the way it goes. Yep. Yeah, yeah, it was me, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't get hit, though. Yeah, go on. Oh, yeah, good point. Okay. Okay, good. Good point, actually. Well, I'm a martial artist. I've been doing martial arts for 45 years, and I've studied four different martial arts majorly. Karate, Aikido, Bagua Chan, and Tai Chi. I came to this dilemma because the practice of karate is extremely violent. When someone attacks you, you do quite serious damage to them. So when I became a Buddhist at the age of 23, I had the dilemma. And so I never practiced martial arts to be, in a sense, standing out in the street and taking on all comers to see that my prowess as a martial artist. But I recognised I had a level of self-defence in there. I then discovered a martial art that could subdue an attacker without harming them, which was the practice of Tai Chi. And the famous Master Wong, who was the teacher of my teacher, was able to completely subdue people, even spin them onto the floor without causing them harm. And he did it numerous times. In the other context of... Yeah. Yeah. I think you have a right to draw lines in the sand, but look, if someone comes and abuses me and tells me that I'm a complete idiot and a coward and I, you know, so what? What am I defending? My ego? Big deal. No problem. If they're holding a knife at my throat and going to take my wallet, here. If I've got two, I'll give them both. You know, I'd rather lose a wallet and some credit cards than my life. It has to be degrees. If someone's attacking me physically, then hopefully my Tai Chi would be enough to subdue them without harming myself and others. Hopefully my practice of 30 years might work. Don't know if it would, because I've never been in that situation. You have to, one of the things in Buddhism that said that you also have to defend your good name. If someone is out there saying a lot of lies about you that is defamatory, then you have to be quite clear about going and seeing that person or clearing your name. I think that's important. And it's not about being aggressive. You've got two things in Buddhism. You've got anger, which is the desire to harm, and you've got assertiveness, which is speaking the truth. Buddhists, it's fine for a Buddhist to be assertive. It's not fine for a Buddhist to be angry. So anger being that desire to cause the other person harm. That's not okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, go on. So we're back to your question, yeah.
Yeah,
so yes, I would I would not lie for my friend. I would say to him, look, I'm really sorry, but you're going to have to deal with this straight up. Now, if it meant him, if his parents were going to kill him, lie, all right? All right? But I'm sure all they would do would give him a really difficult time and he'd feel bad about himself. So it wasn't going to be the end of his life. So say, look, I'm really sorry, but I can't stand there and lie for you. Right? But there are situations where someone can ask you a question and you can say, I'm not going to tell you. I've asked my teacher questions and he go, just wouldn't give me an answer. Fair enough. You don't have to comply with everyone's decision. I once asked him a question, he said, I'm not telling you. End of story. So that again is developing your wisdom within situations. And these are the grey areas which I think are really important. And I like answering these questions in Buddhism because it's the way to develop your mind. Sure, you can be compassionate and feel compassion for people that are suffering, but how are you compassionate for someone who's yelling at you? How do you deal with that one? How do you deal with the everyday problems that are in the grey area of morality? Difficult. Oh, here was the other one. This was in 1978. This question was posed to a monk who now runs the Perth Centre in Western Australia. If, I really like this answer, you come across a spider, he's got his web close to the ground and an ant has just got caught in the web. Do you save the ant or do you walk past it? And I was going, that's an interesting question. I was right at the beginning of my Buddhism. And I was going, don't know about that. There's the spider, he's sitting there, he's about to have lunch. Ant's just got caught in the web, struggling, one foot in. Okay, so what do you do? Come on, answer, what do you do? Sorry, what? Okay, well there's that answer. You walk past it because someone will take food away from you. Okay. What would you do? You wouldn't touch? Okay, so we've got two non-touches. You wouldn't touch as well? Okay, so there's three non-touches. Okay, come on. All right, put your hands up, those that wouldn't touch. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. And the rest you would pull the ant out? Ah, come on. You can't sit on the fence. What do you mean it depends? Okay, come on. Oh, okay, all right. Okay, let's say it's a daddy long legs, all right? All right, forget about the giant wolf spider that's about to munch on an ant. We're talking about a spider sitting in its web. That's all. Yeah, I get your point. There's a grey area. All right? Little daddy long legs or big daddy long legs ant caught. Okay, now, over to you. Yeah, and that was the answer that the monk gave. He said, look, he said, you've just become part of the equation. If you save the ant, the spider won't die. You just missed out on lunch. And spiders can hang around for an awful long while without lunch. So you've saved the ant, you haven't really harmed it. You're not killing the spider to save the ant, okay? You're just making him a little bit hungrier. And you've saved the ant. He said, because you're part of the equation, you can be compassionate. A little bit more difficult for the ant. Not for the spider, but very compassionate for the ant. Sorry? Yeah, when you're not there, the spider will get something else. but at least you've saved one ant. So not a bad outcome. Situation, my friend, and this was put to one Tibetan Lama, my friend had a cat and it had a tick in the head of the cat. And he said, if I leave the tick in, the cat will die. If I pull the tick out, the tick will die. What do I do? And the Lama said, what did you do? He said, well, I pulled the tick out. And he said, best situation, you couldn't do anything but that. Your decision was to save the cat, but not to kill the tick. And he tried to get the tick out, and in fact, if you know something about Australian ticks, you can unwind them clockwise, by the way. They burrow in this way. And if you're clever, you can pull them out, if you want to be very clever. So he said, no, unfortunately the tick died. He said, well, you did the best you could in that situation. Look, let's face it. We drive our cars, we walk on the ground, we're killing beings all the time, whether we like to or not. We could become part of the Jain religion, of the sky-clad Jain religion, where you don't wear any clothes, because the making of clothes creates, this is not all Jains, this is just one particular sect, the making of clothes causes beings to be killed, the planting of cotton. You eat only ripe fruit that's fallen from the tree, and wherever you walk you have a broom and you brush away any insects in your path, and you live your whole existence like that. Buddhists tend to see that as extreme, because while you are so busy protecting your karma, you may not be helping many, many beings. You may not be doing great work for others. You may not be in a hospital as a nurse helping people because you've decided that you want to keep yourself totally pure. I'm not really criticising that existence, but from a Buddhist point of view, it tends to be a bit extreme. For those people, that's fine. And yes, they may be very holy people and doing other work, who knows. But for doing that, a Buddhist would say that's rather extreme. There was, interesting story, when Buddhism came to Tibet, the king at the time invited two practitioners. One was Indian and one was Chinese. The Chinese one name was Huashan. And he got these two guys to debate their Buddhism, and he said, whoever wins the debate over 7 days, I will adopt that Buddhism for Tibet. And so the Huashan, the Chinese practitioner, said, well, I believe that the slightest movement in the mind creates karma, which then leads to action, which then leads to negative action, and which leads to more locking oneself into samsara, into suffering. So my whole practice is to sit and keep my mind completely blank. Completely blank. That's my whole practice. Just blank. You know, plain screen. And therefore nothing happens, and I'm creating nothing. The Indian practitioner said, yeah. He said, while you're doing that, you're not even doing anything good. You're not helping anyone. You're not being compassionate. You're not helping old people or sick people or doing anything as you walk past a sick person, giving them some alms or food or whatever. Now, our practice is, at the risk of creating some negativity, we try to do very positive action. And the Tibetan king went, yeah, I like that one. You can go home, Huashan. Yeah. And Huashan went back to China. So there was that answer. And again, and this is why Buddhism is called the middle way, between the extremes. To be able to do the best you can with what you've got, even though it's going to be imperfect to some degree. As long as you are doing the best you can, and you know what the best you can is, we have in this inbuilt radar about what is a good action and what is a bad action. Sometimes it can get misled, but if, particularly within the Buddhist culture, we understand these practices, and we've got them here. Right view, the way you look at things. Right intention. What's your intention? What's your intention for doing this? In fact, there's a Buddhist psychologist in Los Angeles, and she has one question. What's your intention for doing this? And if you look at that, if you ask yourself what your intention is, you'll pretty much nail it. And if it's a negative action, it's about ego grasping and gain. If it's a positive action, it's usually about generosity and compassion. So right intention. Right speech. Not abusing people. Not causing them unhappiness. That doesn't mean that if you have a child, you don't discipline. It doesn't mean that if a child's about to stick its hand in the fire, you don't yell at it and say, stop! You don't go, oh darling, don't do that, while it's gone ahead and put its hand in the fire. You sometimes have to use rather loud methods with kids. But again, the intention, you go back to the intention. What's the intention? Not to cause harm, but to prevent harm. Right action. Out of the intention comes right action. Right livelihood. Becoming a mercenary in an army is not a right livelihood. Right effort. This is the mental development of the mind. Keeping the mind steady and clear. Right mindfulness, right concentration. These are all to do with the practice of meditation. Because the practice of meditation strengthens the mind to be able to carry out the functions in a positive way within your life. So who was the Buddha? The Buddha was someone that came along, woke himself up and said, these things work. Try them out. Test them out. Don't take my word for it. Just check it out. Find out if meditation works for you. Sit down and meditate and see how your mind is afterwards. Is it happy, content and peaceful? Or is it negative, agitated and upset? You can find out by doing the practice. So the Buddha was a function of enlightenment to gain us enlightenment. The Buddha arrived to find out the truth, and when he found out the truth, he then decided that the best way to enlighten beings was to teach them. Because it's said that the Buddha cannot enlighten you with his own hand. If a Buddha was sitting here in front of us, he could not enlighten you just by being there. But he can teach you how he did it. And that's the amazing thing. Here's the method. I did this. This is how I got to enlightenment. Now no secrets, I'm going to show you the whole deal. If you want to practice it, this is the way you do it. Fantastic. And so far, 2,500 years later, people are doing it and going, yeah, actually this stuff works. And now science jumping on the bandwagon, particularly with meditation, and going, wow, this stuff works. But even, I just got a report the other day, in 8 weeks, the brain, the physical brain, in 8 weeks of meditation, the physical brain has actually changed. This frontal cortex thickens from the practice of meditation in 8 weeks. I've been able to measure it. That's incredible. 20 years ago, if you said that to science, they'd say, oh, don't be silly, the brain doesn't change, it just decays. It doesn't shift. Are there any doctors here? Doctors? Yeah. So don't you agree that things have changed in the medical science about... Yeah, it's shifted.
It's shown that the main effect of meditation on depression is that it affects your more effective.
More effective than Prozac. Do you have a report on that anyway?
I had a report.
Yeah. There you go. Meditation more effective than Prozac. Don't tell the pharmaceutical companies. They'll try and market meditation. Here, a little bottle of meditation. Yeah. There's the list of benefits from meditation are incredible. You know, there's no downside. One of the cautions I would say, if someone was schizophrenic, there could be a problem teaching the meditation. I think that's certainly a limitation that one would have to be aware of. And I did have a guy come to me once who said that he believed he was schizophrenic. He'd been to a psychiatrist who said he was schizophrenic and he was hearing voices, and could he meditate? And I said, look, on the condition, and I was really strict with him, that you only do breathing meditation, nothing complex, and that if this continues, you go and see another psychiatrist go back to your old one. And, you know, I was really strict about that, because that's a point of being very careful. And he wrote to me later and he said, yes, look, I'm meditating and I feel better, but I am still having episodes, and I have definitely gone, and I even found him a psychiatrist who worked with him. And he wrote to me a couple of years later and he said, look, I'm really fine. He said, I'm on medication to working with it, but he said, I'm still meditating, and he said, my life is actually going okay. So he was able to control it. In those situations, you can't just go, okay, well, you have to again use your wisdom. So if someone comes to you who has that kind of a problem, or you're unsure about it, you know, really work with your medical practitioners, because they do know how to work with this stuff. But on the other side, for most 99% of people, meditation is incredibly beneficial. Some people say, which is kind of funny, they go, oh, when I meditate, my mind's more agitated. No, your mind has always been agitated. You just haven't recognised it before. Buddhists say that you have, get this one, 65 mind moments to a finger snap. That means your mind can move 65 moments in one finger snap. I haven't been able to measure it. It's an arbitrary figure. But our minds do move very fast. When we think we're multitasking, what we're doing is very quick scanning from one task to the other, very, very quickly. We're not actually doing this. All right? We're going bing, 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 very fast. But the brain can do that. The mind can do that. And the capacity of the mind is extraordinary. And the capacity of the mind within a Buddhist context is way beyond comprehension. But they even discovered with people they call savants. Have you come across this word, savants? You've come across these words, savants, haven't you? No? A savant is someone that has, and often they have some retardation in one function of the brain. So, did anyone see the movie Rain Man or hear about it? No, probably haven't. Okay. It's someone that has a retardation in one area of their brain, but the other area is incredibly expanded. And this is just a normal human being. And there's one guy who can do complex calculations in his brain to the computation of pi to 22,000 numbers. And they tested him. And they had a battery of people with a supercomputer that had printed out pi to 22,000 numbers, and they checked every one, and he just sat there and reeled them off. It took him 5 hours. But not only that, he had a break in the middle and came back to where he'd finished off, and he was completely accurate. Extraordinary capacity. There was another guy, this guy particularly, who had this ability. He didn't have any retardation in any other area, and he said it happened. He was 7 years of age. He had an epileptic fit, and his mind shifted. Another guy got hit in the head with a baseball at the age of 16 or something, and he could remember every day from that day forth until he was in his 40s. If you said Tuesday the 25th of March, it was sunny in the morning, raining in the afternoon. It was a Saturday. And he could reel them all off. And he said, I don't know how I do it. He said, you ask me a question, pops into my head. The same guy with the numbers said, the numbers just flash before me. There was another guy, he couldn't speak. But they flew him over Paris. He flew over Paris in a helicopter. He came back, and on a thing this big, he drew in pencil the whole of Paris, even to the number of windows in a building accurately, from looking at it once. And it's documented on YouTube and a whole heap of places. That's a capacity of the mind that isn't even enlightened. So you could imagine when they talk about the qualities of a Buddha's mind that is omniscient, that knows every past, present and future thought of every being all at one moment, you're starting to see the capacity of what our consciousness can do. And the point that the Buddha talked about was that we have Buddha nature. At the very depth of our consciousness, we have Buddha nature. So to become enlightened, we are not gaining something, we are removing the obscurations to that nature of mind. That's all we're doing. We are purifying the blockages. We're taking them away till the mind becomes omniscient. Because if we had to acquire it outside ourselves, impossible. If you didn't have it as an original nature, unrealized but original nature, you couldn't discover it. You couldn't come from the ultimate consciousness that was finite to an infinite consciousness. You couldn't do it. But the absolute nature, the Buddha nature of our mind, is infinite consciousness. And so the practice of, and this is the ultimate secret, the Buddha's, or the revelation, the Buddha said that you can achieve this level of awareness. And at that point, you can create the most extraordinary good for all beings. If I know the mind of every being in this room, if I was a Buddha and knew the mind of every being in this, how could I interact with you if my whole mission was to be compassionate? How could I interact with you to be able to help you on your path? It'd be incredible. What a gift that you would have. If you can do that with all beings, they say at the moment of, and there's all these in some of the texts, they talk about at the moment of enlightenment. The moment of enlightenment, when a sentient being becomes a Buddha, that Buddha sends out millions and billions of beings to help other beings. It's said that there is no being in the universe that at some point hasn't been helped by a Buddha. And if we had that capacity, which the Buddha says that we can achieve, then we can do infinite good. And so, again, it was more about what the Buddha could do for us, and that we could become is the important part about who is the Buddha. He started a religion, but it's the function of the religion that's important. My own teacher once said, he said, oh, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, just words. There is only one practice. Good heart. That's all. That is a spiritual person. Good heart. And if you examine what that is, you come to the truth of Buddhism. And in fact, you actually come to the truth of all the great religions in their pure essence, is what is good heart. Finding good heart should be, in a sense, the exploration of our lives, because that's the thing that brings us our happiness. Our whole drive in life is to be happy. Let's just accept that. We want to be happy, we never want suffering. That's the whole drive in our lives. So find out what creates happiness. And everything that is based on ignorance, hatred and greed is going to cause us misery. Plainly obvious. A greedy person never has enough. An angry person is angry at everything that comes up. So if we can start to modify those, and an ignorant person doesn't know how to act in the world. So if we cover ignorance, anger and greed, the three poisons, then we start to act in the world in a way that is beneficial for ourselves and others. I've just about finished, guys. Now, any questions or any things you want to discuss? Yep, go on. Yeah, please. Ah, good. This is a good question. Buddhism and God. Okay. Buddhism doesn't look at God as a creator. Right? It depends what we label as God. This is the problem. If we say God is a creator, then Buddhism doesn't believe in that. If we use God as the principle of universal love and compassion, if that's the principle, then Buddhism believes in that. So in a sense, Buddhism believes in the qualities, you could say, of God, but not of the personification or the personality. Buddhists don't believe that there's a guy sitting up there going, nah, you lose, nah, you win. Okay? That's not a Buddhist concept. But if... Yeah, the energy of compassion, if you want to call that God, the energy of compassion, love and wisdom, which is the very nature of our consciousness and of the universe, if you say that's God, then that's fine. If you call that God nature, that's no problem for a Buddhist. But it's not the controlling factor or the creator, because Buddhists believe that our consciousness has never been created, that has always existed. This is a big concept. There has been no creator to the beginning of our consciousness. The consciousness that you are dealing with at the moment, the continuation of that consciousness, has never had a creator. It has always existed and will always exist as an energy form. It has had no beginning and will have no end. Yep?
Yeah, sorry, I was wondering a little bit more about the second part of my earlier
question. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, and again, it's interesting. Like the Buddha actually said, this is an interesting line. He said, "No prisoner in a jail should not be ever given. How can I put it? No prisoner in a jail should be told that they will never be released. That will create insanity." So he said that all prisoners should be given the possibility of release. Now, there are definitely people who are criminally insane that if we release them into society, they will cause people harm. So there are certain limitations within society. And yes, the laws of the country hopefully should be adhered to. But there may be exceptions. We see laws of countries where political prisoners who are asking for freedom, who are working for freedom in a in a compassionate way and non-violent way, are still kept in prison. A Buddhist would say that person should not be in prison. Do you see what I mean? Yeah, but it's not contravening all local laws. But very. Yes, absolutely, and it's again intention behind it. There may be a law, say, in a country where you're not allowed to practice Buddhism, but a Buddhist would practice Buddhism underneath that. They wouldn't go by the law and go, okay. But, per se, Buddhism doesn't create violence. It's not a violent religion, so it doesn't... This is why the Dalai Lama was very strong about the Tibetans never becoming terrorists. And he said the reason that Tibetans and that he is so respected is because they never became terrorists against the communist Chinese. Even if someone said, oh, they're justified because their land's been taken over and 1.6 million people were killed, he absolutely forbade the Tibetans to become violent. And he said, and the reason that we have support of the world, even to a degree, and even the support of India, is because we were never violent. And that was a really... And he sticks to that 100%. That doesn't mean that you can't do peaceful demonstrations. As long as they're peaceful. So, sorry, what? It's been a bad predicament since 1959. It's had, as I said, 1.6 million Tibetans killed. It's had its forest logs 24 hours a day since 1959. Its people have been disenfranchised. And their country's pretty much been wiped out, and the religion's been suppressed. So, yeah, they've been a really bad way. interesting story. Before, and this the Dalai Lama explained this, before Tibet was Buddhist, it was incredibly violent and warlike. Prior to the 6th century, the Tibetans were one of the fiercest marauding countries in the world. They nearly took over China, and they were incredibly tough and fierce warriors. Within 100 years of becoming Buddhist, they were completely peaceful. All the army stopped, all the violence stopped, everything. Completely overtook the country. But the Dalai Lama predicted, I think the 13th predicted, that Tibet would be overrun due to its past karma. That it had to suffer the karma of invasion because of its previous violent past. So this was predicted, you know, well, as I said, the 13th Dalai Lama, well before 1959. So yeah, unfortunately those things happened. The Buddhism also is said to only to last, the Buddha predicted that Buddhism would last only 5,000 years. Okay? And at the end of that 5,000 years, there would be a degeneration of consciousness in terms of religious or spiritual practice. And then it would take quite a while before the next Buddha came, which was Maitreya Buddha. So even Buddhism is impermanent in a sense, not the ultimate practice, but the practice of Guru Shakyamuni, the Buddha, only takes 5,000 years. We're 2,500 years into it. The last 500 years is predicted that Buddhism will be a quaint religion found only on bookshelves, examined by scholars, but no one gaining any realizations. So, you better hurry up. You've only got 2,000 years to sort your stuff out before you miss the boat and you have to wait for Maitreya. So, get on with it. Okay. Yeah, please. Lying, yes. Interesting point. So if someone's dying, whether to tell them the truth, what's going to happen to them? Yeah. If the person is okay with dying, it happened to a friend of mine who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He was 54 and he died within 2 weeks. It was incredible. This is just after Christmas. He wanted to know whether he was dying or not because he needed to know. And the doctor wouldn't tell him. So a friend of mine who was a doctor went in and confronted the doctor in front of him and said, my friend wants to know whether he's dying. And the oncologist said, yes, he is dying. And he freaked out naturally, but at least he was able to deal with it. So he really wanted to know. And he figured, and my friend, the other doctor, figured he could handle the truth. If someone is so terrified of dying that by telling them the truth it's going to cause them incredible anguish and agitation, then I think in those situations you can be a little bit skillful and say, look, we're doing the best we can for you at the moment, because it's important that they have a peaceful death. But if someone directly says to you, look, am I dying and I need to know, and you think in their capacity they can deal with it, then I think you need to tell them. But I think in those circumstances you have to be compassionate as much as you can, and you have to be present to that situation. Now, I wasn't present when my friend wanted to know whether he was going to live or die with that doctor, but knowing my friend and knowing him for many years, he would want to know. I would want to know. You know? So if someone thought that they were being compassionate, going, well, you know, you've got 6 weeks to live, I'm not going to tell you, they're not being compassionate to me. And if they knew me really well, they'd go, no, he'd really want to know. I'd want to be getting well and truly into my practices by then, the death process. But again, it depends on the situation, it depends on the capacity of the person and whether they can deal with that information. And so you would say, look, we're doing the best we can for you at the moment. It's not clear, maybe. Because it isn't clear. This friend of mine was given 3 months and he died in 2 weeks. The first doctor gave him 3 years. The second doctor gave him 3 months and he only lasted 2 weeks. So everyone was wrong, actually. So in that circumstance, you can be incorrect. A friend of mine's, her father was dying in Malaysia before Christmas. And it was absolutely certain that he was going to die within a week. And at the moment, he's sitting up watching television. He's 93, and the family was brought in from Australia and everywhere to be at his bedside, and they waited there for a week, and they took all the plugs off, and they're still waiting, and they're still waiting. He's up watching television now. So you can't tell. You really can't tell. He was definitely going to go. It was absolutely on the cards, but he's just decided he wasn't going to check out. Now, he's probably frail, and he'll probably die at some point, but then he wasn't to. Another friend of mine's father was the same. He was 94. And my friend rang me and said, "Oh, my father will die tonight." I said, "Oh, that's terrible." He said, "Yes, definitely." He rings me in the morning, and he said, "Well, my son, his grandson, went in, and he's sitting there chatting to the nurses eating breakfast." So, you know, he lasted another 3 or 4 months, and he said, my friend said, the 3 or 4 months that he lasted was the most exquisite time he'd ever had with his father in his life. He said the bonding was so fabulous, and he said, and the day I walked in, he said, "Uh-uh." He said, "Dad, I think you're going to go today." And his father said, "Yep, I think this is it. Everything's shutting down." And he actually did die that day. But he had 3 months from the time when it was certain that he was dying, he had 3 months of exquisite connection with his father. And at 94, it was very peaceful. So you can't tell, really. And you do, again, with any of these situations, check your motivation and do the best you can. You know, in 20 years' time, you might be able to do better because you've gained wisdom. But at the time, you do the best you can with the best intention. And that's as good as you can get. And then you don't have any regret or guilt around it. And I think that's really important. Anyway, that's enough for tonight, folks. Thank you very much. I hope you found something interesting. It's always good to see you guys.